it's been so hard for people to come to their own conclusions about how they feel. Do you like the Muslim Brotherhood? Maybe not. Did they win the election? Yes, they did.
Ambivalence in the media over recent events in Egypt. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The trial of George Zimmerman has garnered wall-to-wall coverage on TV news, but why?
Trials are actually breaking news on a schedule. You can plan around it, but you still have that breaking news patina, and it keeps your viewers glued.
And Bob travels to London to see just how crazy the Brits really are over this summer's royal baby.
Coverage is going to be so over the top and so disgustingly intrusive. I'm personally amazed that The Sun hasn't installed a camera up inside Kate Middleton's womb.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Is Egypt's military a hero stepping in to restore order, or does it threaten to put the country under indefinite military rule?
That's the question, isn't it? Or, to put it another way, how should we feel about this? The American media don't know. And let's face it, usually they do. And it comes out in the coverage, subtly or blatantly. For instance, how should we feel about the Egyptian military forcing Al Jazeera's TV affiliate off the air and silencing the Muslim Brotherhood's TV channel? We can't decide. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported Wednesday that, quote, life has somehow gotten better for many people across Egypt. Gas lines have disappeared, power cuts have stopped, and the police have returned to the streets. Such a rapid improvement could give rise to conspiracy theories. Deb Amos, who reports on the Middle East for NPR, says that this conspiracy theory might have something to it.
Look, I'm in the part of the world where conspiracy theories are served for breakfast, but sometimes they're correct. Now, part of the gas lines have been explained in that people were so nervous before the June 30th protest that they were all stocking up on gas. What's interesting is the police. The police had disappeared in Cairo, and that had caused great unease in the major cities. This is a force that has been trained to distrust and arrest the Muslim Brotherhood. So the fact that they appear after President Morsi's ousting is just plain curious, isn't it?
Yeah. Can we expand the conspiracy to include the Gulf states? Al Jazeera, which of course is funded by Qatar. 22 members of Al Jazeera's flagship station resigned on Monday over what they said was biased coverage of Morsi's ouster. Which side was Al Jazeera biased toward? And is this part of a broader issue with the Gulf states in Egypt in general?
Let's start with this. Al Jazeera Arabic was a band leader for the revolts against Mubarak. It is widely said that Al Jazeera Arabic is quite pro-Muslim Brotherhood. And so when this protest broke out, there were complaints that Al Jazeera Arabic wasn't covering it enough. Its rival, Al Arabiya, is linked to the Saudi Arabian government, which is anti-Muslim Brotherhood. So for the first time, people who are watching these two stations in the region are aware of how biased they are.
And this makes me wonder both about the coverage there and about the coverage here. I mean, it struck us that even though our best media outlets strive for impartiality, there's usually an American subtext, you know, a sense of shared values of who's in the right and who's in the wrong. And obviously, we knew who to root for during the fall of Mubarak. I just think the fall of Morsi is a little more problematic. As Tim Sebastian wrote in The Times on the 7th, Morsi didn't steal his election, nor did the Muslim Brotherhood. They won each and every vote.
Indeed. And one of the things that I noted as I was watching those crowds the green lasers and the fireworks displays, they were complicated, expensive, and I thought there was a lot of money that went into that. And indeed, we had heard from people who have just come back to Beirut from Cairo that they'd never seen so many rich Egyptians on the street. We are looking at something much more complex than those first couple of days. I think the future of Egypt is very much in doubt, and it is the most populous Arab country. So goes Egypt, so goes the rest of the region. It is a very worrying story, just beginning to get that kind of coverage. You know, Egypt was eclipsed by the Syria story, and so we didn't really have that much coverage of what was happening with Morsi as he fiddled with the constitution, the economic distress. All of those things really have not been in our newspapers over the past year. So the crowd on June 30th came as a big surprise.
The coverage we saw on cable, the pundits all bloviating, seemed to show just terrific confusion.
Yes.
Because if you're for democracy, you have to kind of be for at least Morsi continuing out his term.
And if you are for good governance, there was some argument for what the military did. This is a country that had only 3 months left of foreign reserves moving towards the abyss, and there was certainly no doubt about that. What we don't know, and there has been a lot of bloviating, as you say, is what does this mean for political Islam in the region? Does this say if you are an Islamist, you can forget about democracy, you're never really allowed to take power, and the only way to go is violence? I've seen a lot of writing about that. That's why it's been so hard for people to come to their own conclusions about how they feel. Do you like the Muslim Brotherhood? Maybe not. Did they win the election? Yes, they did. They bungled the chance that they had. Can you argue that the deck was stacked against them? Perhaps it was. I think it is very troubling that the leadership of a democratically elected government is now in jail. It kind of reminds one of Latin America.
And it doesn't seem like all those democratically minded protesters are protesting the closing down of media outlets.
You know, when we first met them, they were on Tahrir Square for 18 days, and we loved them. Many were English speaking, they were well educated, they were using social media, they wanted to topple a dictator. Their demands have gotten a little bit more complicated. It is also true that what we consider the liberal opposition is undemocratic. And the conservative Muslim Brotherhood are the most democratic group in the country. And I think that's what's made all of this so confusing, to figure out what side you're on.
Deb, thanks again.
Thank you, Brooke.
Deb Amos covers the Middle East for NPR. We spoke to her from Beirut.
The French term coup d'etat translates essentially to strike against the state. The military removal of Mohamed Morsi was surely that, though the Obama administration shuns the term, and the interim Egyptian leadership resolutely rejects it. Here's Egyptian ambassador to the U.S. Mohamed Tawfik on ABC's This Week.
Egypt has not undergone a military coup, and it is certainly not run by the military. Today there is an interim president in place.
This is not a coup.
Absolutely not.
After some consideration, the Associated Press determined this week that coup is the right word to describe what happened in Cairo. Noah Feldman, a professor of constitutional and international law at Harvard, explains why the White House simply won't say it.
Congress passed a law called the Foreign Assistance Act, which, as amended, says that if a duly elected president or head of state of a country is removed by a military coup or a military decree, we have to stop immediately all aid to that country. Egypt gets about $1.55 billion of U.S. aid a year. Almost all of that money goes to the Egyptian military. They're totally dependent on our aid.
And the U.S. is totally dependent on Egypt as the guarantor of what passes for peace in the Middle East.
The United States pays to assure that the Egyptian military continues to treat Israel as not exactly a friendly neighbor, but at least not an enemy. And that's been crucial to maintaining some semblance of regional stability.
Can we go back just one Egyptian putsch, please, to the unseating of Hosni Mubarak in 2011? That also was the work of the military, but at the time it was not deemed by the State Department to be a coup d'etat. He was a duly elected leader.
In my view, he was not a duly elected leader. There certainly was an election that led to Mubarak becoming president, but it was not a democratic election in the true sense of the term. On top of that, the Foreign Assistance Act also says that if you have a military coup, aid could be suspended and then restarted once a democratic election takes place. And in this case, there was, in fact, a democratic election, and President Morsi was elected. So even if there had been some legal reason to suspend aid, there was also a reason to restart the aid again. This time, it's probable that the military in Egypt thinks that their best bet is to have a presidential election. But of course, they won't allow a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood to run for office. The U.S. government might wink and say, oh, well, they're having an election, and that's good enough for us.
The delicacy of semantics often figures into diplomacy. And there's actually a fairly recent precedent for this very situation. Can you tell me about Honduras?
In 2009, the military of Honduras, working alongside the legislature and the Supreme Court of the country, removed President Manuel Zelaya one night. They took him out of his palace in his pajamas and deposited him in a nearby country. And the United States government struggled at first, but eventually did determine that it was a coup d'etat. I and some co-authors did an independent study of the events for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Honduras. And I will tell you that that was, if anything, less of a coup than what we've just seen in Egypt, because the president had, in fact, broken the Constitution. But, of course, then the military broke the rules of the Constitution, and yet it was counted as a coup by the U.S. government.
All the hand-wringing about the word choice here seems to be rooted in the ambivalence. On the one hand, Morsi had kind of stacked the deck in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. On the other hand, he was, as you say, a democratically elected president. Does the word choice have any impact on how we can resolve our ambivalence?
You know, I don't really think we should have ambivalence about this question. Coup is a word that has a very specific, ordinary English meaning. Our government and others also doesn't want to call things what they are. It's the job of the media to call out the government when it's equivocating for its own reasons.
If reporters do as you suggest and simply call a thing by its name, that means leaving out a whole lot of the context. Is there a shorthand way of using the C word while also offering some of the context that we've just discussed?
Yeah, you could say after days of public protests weakened President Morsi, the military removed him in a coup. The government of the United States, subject to its laws, has not yet been willing to call that a coup and may not do so at all. That's sweet, that's short, it's compact, it's accurate, and I think it provides context. But notice that it does, in fact, say the truth.
Noah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Noah Feldman is a professor of constitutional and international law at Harvard Law School and a columnist for Bloomberg View.
Coming up, have you seen the news about New Jersey?
No.
Well, neither is much of New Jersey. The last local TV newscast is gone.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the last few weeks, the cameras of cable news have been focused on Sanford, Florida, and the trial of George Zimmerman for the shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The killing spawned conversations about race, guns, Florida's stand-your-ground laws, and a Million Hoodie March. But in the 3 weeks since the beginning of Zimmerman's trial for second-degree murder, broader discussions of race in the U.S. have taken a backseat to murder trial minutia. Eric Deggans, media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, says trials are like catnip to 24-hour news channels.
Trials are actually breaking news on a schedule. So the great thing about a trial, of course, is that you know it starts at about 9 a.m. It's going to end at about 4 or 5 p.m. every day. You generally know at the beginning of the day which witnesses are going to be on, and there's a sense that witnesses could say anything. You can plan around it, but you still have that breaking news patina, and it keeps your viewers glued.
There are also great narratives about the human condition, I guess.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a reason why there's an entire genre of scripted television that's based around trials and criminal justice. As much as you want to look at the Zimmerman trial and sort of say, well, that's tabloidy and that's crime and why are we paying attention to that, I think this situation sort of distills a bunch of important truths about America. Can people get the same level of justice depending on what their race is or depending on who they kill?
If you look at the coverage of last year's Casey Anthony murder trial, well, the media were obsessed with that, too. And if that isn't a tabloid story, I don't know what is.
But at least in the Zimmerman case, there are larger questions to justify the attention. It took over a month of protesting and all kinds of public comment to push Florida authorities into even prosecuting Zimmerman after he shot and killed Trayvon Martin last year. Mm. And it became not only a national event, it became an international event. So to have the trial that resulted from all of that attention also get a high level of attention makes a lot more sense.
Let's say the attention makes sense. Do you think that the coverage is responsible?
Well, I don't like the way in which a lot of this coverage seems to be reducing this to almost like a sports event. You get the sense that if you replace prosecution and defense with the names of sports teams, you know, you'd feel like you were watching SportsCenter.
That was the state star witness. How'd she do? Where do we stand?
That testimony is probably the biggest coup for the defense.
Because I think that it was a huge mistake for the defense to call Tracy Martin. It was a big mistake.
The prosecution has lost points by putting her on the stand.
I mean, when the story first broke, we heard from all kinds of voices, from Deepak Chopra to LeBron James to President Obama, especially on the issues of race. But where are those voices now? Where are those questions now?
The reason why we're not hearing them now is because they haven't been a part of the trial, because there's not much evidence pointing to race as an element of what happened between these two people. George Zimmerman didn't use any racial slurs when he was talking to the police during his 911 call or in his subsequent descriptions of what happened. A best friend of Trayvon Martin, who says that she was on the phone with him right before the fight started that ended with his shooting death, said that he used a couple of slurs in describing George Zimmerman. But that was mostly his attempt to describe someone that he thought was following him.
You've written in the Tampa Bay Times and also in your book, Race Baiter, that too often the impulse in race-tinged controversies is to hang a lot of ancillary discussions on the event because this is the only time the world is really paying attention. Do you think in this case we should keep raising those questions, or because they're not part of the trial, we shouldn't?
That is a tough question. CNN, for example, did a really interesting special about the N-word and how it's used. And they also talked about the term cracker, which is for some people is a comparable word that's used for white people.
Oh, and come on.
For some people. And for me, it was the kind of program that I thought, boy, I wish this had happened 6 months ago.
These words can cause a visceral reaction when people hear them, but they played a pivotal role in two major stories this week, the George Zimmerman murder trial and the allegations around celebrity chef Paula Deen. It's a catalyst for an honest and difficult conversation. That's all we're trying to do here.
When you have that kind of discussion, the discussion isn't really about the actual issue that's on the table. It's about these larger issues that are proxies. So if you can have this discussion outside of conflict, then you can actually try to understand the other person's point of view a little more. You don't do that when you're in the middle of a heated battle. I'm constantly pushing for coverage of race that falls outside of crisis. Let's consider making race a more central and steady part of our news process. Let's talk about it more often.
Ultimately, will trial coverage of the kind that we've seen in this case be useful to us?
Will we learn something from all of this coverage? I don't know, because so much of the impact of this trial is going to be wrapped up in what the verdict is. That's when we're going to see all this commentary about race and people talking about the criminal justice system. If the jury comes back and says that George Zimmerman is guilty of second-degree murder, there are going to be people who feel like, finally, the system got pushed into delivering justice for Trayvon Martin's family. And there will also be a lot of people who will feel that the system got bullied into sacrificing a guy who should not be going to jail.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times and author of Race Baiter: How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation.
A new TV show launched in New Jersey this week called Chasing NJ. It's a bid to revolutionize local TV news, apparently by modeling it after syndicated celebrity gossip show TMZ.
I'm chasing New Jersey's Bermuda Triangle, also known as Round Valley Reservoir. Do you think it's just crazy weather making people vanish, or is there something more?
A New Jersey woman had her children seized because she moved her family into a storage locker in the middle of difficult times. Now she's trying to get her children back. Tell me what you think. Should she get them?
Bayonne's own superhero of fitness, Captain Bayonne.
How you doing?
Is he a superhero and a godsend to an overweight, overfat city of Bayonne? Is he just nuts?
Chasing NJ is the latest potential fix for Northern New Jersey's long-running TV news problem. The region is historically undercovered because it's sandwiched between two enormous media markets, New York and Philadelphia. In fact, New Jersey legislators say that the old news show that Chasing NJ replaced also didn't serve New Jerseyans particularly well. New York Times media reporter Brian Stelter says this problem goes back so far that WWOR's broadcast license includes a special instruction.
There was language included in the license for WWOR many, many years ago that said it would be required to pay special attention to the people of northern New Jersey. The late Senator Frank Lautenberg, for many years, was able to point to that special condition in this license as a way to nudge WWOR to cover New Jersey more often.
A public affairs show, explicitly fashioned after gossip TV, would on the face of it seem to be horrifying. But does it do a better or worse job than the previous broadcast of getting New Jersey issues in front of New Jerseyans?
I'm going to try not to review it in its first week, but I do think that will be the argument that WWR will make. In fact, they already are making that argument, that local news is badly in need of a makeover, of an overhaul, of a redo, of innovation. What is debatable and what will be debated is whether this is the kind of innovation that will actually satisfy viewers. From the first night, one of the stories was about a father who was in hot water because he had named his son Adolf, as in Adolf Hitler. Quite a sensational story for day one, of course, but there are all sorts of stories that these chasers could be covering in the state capital of Trenton, where the show is based. Maybe they're going to make stars out of the local lawmakers and politicians. But on day one, we didn't quite see that.
Now, Brian, this show is heard coast to coast, and perhaps some listeners are wondering, what the hell do they care about a programming change at a fairly obscure New Jersey TV station? But this story does not necessarily end in New Jersey.
That's right, and that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, the FCC almost never, ever revokes a license. If they were to do it in this case, it would have other stations wondering whether they are performing to the standard that they need to perform at in order to keep their license. One of the interesting undertones of all of this is that here we have a number of Democrats, including Senator Menendez, saying the station's not living up to its obligations. WWOR is owned by Rupert Murdoch, one of this nation's best-known conservative-minded media moguls. And so the possibility that we have Democrats here trying to stick it to Rupert Murdoch by going after this station is something that I think also makes it stand out.
And yeah, one more thing. 20th Century Fox has gone out seeking trademarks on Chasing
Texas, Chasing Florida, and Chasing a number of other markets where Fox owns television stations, and actually a couple of markets where it doesn't, which has led to some assumptions that if this goes well in New Jersey, we will see this format spread across the country.
Once again, you're not prepared quite yet to say whether this would be catastrophic or maybe just evolution?
Well, that's the word they're using for it, evolution. I watched it and I came away thinking the same thing that a reviewer for TV News Check said earlier this week. They said the format is so almost blinding that it becomes the star, not the host, not the content, but the format that's so in your face that it becomes a distraction from the news they're trying to convey.
Well, on that subject, the demographics of local TV news skew very, very geriatric. Will suddenly younger people be attracted to the 10 p.m. broadcast, or will they simply just alienate the few people still watching?
Well, the challenge for a show like this is to not come across as a parody of something that young people want to watch. They've cast relatively young reporters, and for that reason, the show may avoid appearing to be a parody of sorts. But when shows try to attract a younger audience, they do end up alienating their core audience. And that would be a big risk because they've had viewers coming to them at 10 p.m. for a long time. Not a big audience, but they did have a loyal audience. And that's partly why some people were surprised they didn't put this new show on in addition to the late local newscast they were already doing.
All right, Brian, thank you, and good chasing.
Thanks.
Brian Stelter covers television for The New York Times.
And now for something not completely different, reality TV. What's your pleasure? The competitive excitement of Dancing with the Stars? The histrionics of Real Housewives? The je ne sais quoi of Duck Dynasty? Or maybe what you'd really prefer is just a little peace and quiet. Like 18 hours of Scandinavian salmon fishing. You know, they love it in Norway. The Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation specializes in some of the world's most boring and, in Norway, most popular TV. Rune Moklebust is head of programming at the network. He says the slow TV movement started in 2009 with a program that showed a train ride through the Norwegian countryside from the train's perspective.
It was supposed to be 7 hours and 4 minutes, but because of a signal trouble in one of the tunnels before the end station, it turned out to be 7 hours and 14 minutes.
And people loved it, right?
Enormously. We've never received so much attention during a program before. It was amazing.
Your next slow program was the ferry ride special.
Yes, because 7 hours is not very long compared to about 134 hours, 5.5 days. There's a ferry ride that goes every day, leaves every day from Bergen, on the western coast of Norway, and goes up to the far north, close to the Russian border, a city called Kirkenes. It's been doing that for over 100 years. So it's perfect slow TV. And this time we wanted to do it live.
Uh-huh.
Because the train ride, that was a recording. So doing it live, we thought that people had the opportunity at least to wave to the program as it sailed by.
Roughly 5 days, run live continuously over the secondary public broadcasting channel. Therefore, no other programming was on that channel, just this ferry ride.
134 hours, 42 minutes, and 45 seconds. And it sounds crazy, but people just got completely addicted to it. They started to show up at the harbors, along the route, on the mountains and waving with flags. And the Queen showed up at the end in her royal yacht waving to us. So it turned out to be a huge national event.
So the 7 hour special got a 15% market share, which was way more than you'd normally get. This one got a 36% market share, right?
That's correct, yeah.
That's incredible for a 5 day show. And so somewhere along the line, you had something called National Firewood Night.
Mm-hmm. First 4 hours of ordinary but a little bit slow produced television with guests and some poetry and music and wood chopping competitions and stuff like that. And then around midnight, we just cooled down, went into the stove and just saw the wood burning for about 8 hours.
Our own Stephen Colbert actually remarked on your show, on his show, The Colbert Report. Let me play you that.
I've got my eye on a wildly popular program from Norway called National Firewood Night, which consisted of mostly people in parkas chatting and chopping in the woods, and then 8 hours of a fire burning in a fireplace. It destroyed the other top Norwegian shows like So You Think You Can Watch Paint Dry and The Amazing Glacier Race.
That's a great piece. I've seen it.
So how'd you feel? Honored?
Of course, definitely, yes.
Is it possible to make slow TV too slow?
I would like to explore that to find out. It's very important to push the limit a little bit.
So how are you pushing the limit?
We would like to do sort of a national knitting night. It's going to be knitting all night.
That is definitely pushing the limit. What's the wildest idea or one of the weirdest suggestions that anyone has made to you for a slow TV show?
A day in a snail's life. But there's one very weird idea that's actually very exciting, and that is watching the watch, the time. Everybody has a feeling of time. You follow the time during the day, but you don't actually sit down and look at it for more than a couple of seconds just to see what it is. So if we can get people to relax, that would be very fun.
This kind of television is a different experience from the kind of diversion that we're used to. Is it intended to be more meditative, like yoga? Or is it just another form of entertainment, only slower?
People like it for different reasons. We're not doing this because we want to change how people look at television. We just want to tell stories and explore new ways of doing that. A lot of the audience say they love this because it's so meditative. They were supposed to watch for 3 minutes, they were sitting for 3 hours. It's so exciting, although nothing is happening. And a lot of the audience say it's so different from everything else. It's so relaxing. That's why they watch it, because the other thing is going too fast. And of course, some people like wood. Some people like the ferry. Some people are train nerds. People watch it because of that as well. It's a lot of different reasons why people watch it. And I think there's also a lot of different reasons why we do it.
Rune, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rune Myklebust is head of programming at the Norwegian Broadcasting Company.
Coming up, I go to London to follow a big story.
But he doesn't stay there for long. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org and Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com. This is NPR.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Did you know that money influences politics? You do? Well, did you know that last year the single largest corporate lobbyist was the crusty old stalwart General Electric? Yeah? How about the second biggest? It's a new arrival called Google. Google's attempt to affect the conversation is interesting, not just because it's just started to seriously lobby Washington, but also because it's leading a caravan from Silicon Valley. Time magazine White House correspondent Michael Scherer explains what took the tech industry so long.
There's long been a libertarian streak out in Silicon Valley. And they look at this city as a place where ideals go to die. And they're still a very idealistic community. That has changed in recent years as Silicon Valley has moved from being a community that basically makes boxes for your desk to something that really is a part of every moment of your life. And so the sort of new tech operates in a world that is heavily regulated. And so they are forced to deal with Washington in a way they weren't before.
How much money are we looking at?
Computers and internet firms are now spending as much lobbying as the defense industry is, and almost as much as the oil and gas industry. Over the next several years, you're going to see more and more of these companies and also the individual billionaires and 100 millionaires who run these companies putting more and more money into elections.
You mentioned that there's a strong libertarian stripe in Silicon Valley. Is that reflected in the kinds of candidates that they're beginning to support?
One of the big untold stories of the 2012 campaign was that President Obama was actually able to raise more money from the Silicon Valley writ large community, the Northern California donor base, than he was from the Hollywood community, the Southern California donor base. That's a real revolution in Democratic politics. That, I think, is changing, though, because what made Silicon Valley a Democratic bastion was really social issues. On other issues, though, they actually have a lot in common with the Republicans. If you talk about issues like taxation and regulation, tort reform, and Republicans in the last few years have become much more savvy about making these connections. You know, as we speak this week, Senator James Inhofe, senior senator from Oklahoma, is having a fundraiser at Google's Washington headquarters. Google likes to think of itself as a very green company, and here they are raising money for the number one climate change denier in the U.S. Senate. And that's because James Inhofe can help Google on a number of other issues that have nothing to do with the temperature of the planet.
Which makes me wonder whether or not Silicon Valley is the place where ideals go to die. You mentioned in your piece that Mark Zuckerberg has launched an advocacy group called Forward.us, FWD.us. What's it designed to do?
This is a group that was founded by Mark Zuckerberg, the billionaire owner of Facebook, with a number of his friends and financiers. They are coming together initially around one issue, immigration reform, which has long actually been a priority of Silicon Valley because they have a real problem in getting highly educated engineers from overseas, getting the visas for these people. And it's really an experiment in flexing their muscle in the new region of super PACs, which are these unlimited campaign advertising groups. And they've been running ads supporting so far senators who were supportive of the comprehensive immigration bill that recently passed out of the Senate. It's also an experiment in how well these tech minds can actually play the political game. And the early indication is that there's quite a learning curve here. You know, their first ads in favor of South Carolina's Lindsey Graham and Alaska Senator Mark Begich actually enraged a lot of people because in addition to touting their support for immigration reform, those ads actually congratulated Lindsey Graham for supporting the Keystone XL pipeline and congratulated Begich for supporting Arctic drilling. These are two issues that are real hot-button issues for environmentalists. And immediately, there was a backlash in Silicon Valley among some of the donors to the group saying, look, I thought I signed up for an immigration reform group, and here you have me using my money to advertise against issues I care a great deal about.
The head of Forward.us, who apparently is Mark Zuckerberg's college roommate, said that the group had a unique ability to influence politics because it can, quote, control massive distribution platforms.
Yeah, and that was actually another big mistake they made. Shortly after that memo was leaked, Joe Green disavowed it, said it didn't reflect what he really thought. Even though clearly this was in the minds and is still in the minds of a number of leaders in Silicon Valley, you had a situation a couple years ago where Hollywood wanted to put in place new intellectual property rules for pirating of movies, basically, online.
You're talking about the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA.
Yes, SOPA, and there was another bill called PIPA. Mm-hmm. And companies like Google were terrified of this because it would have increased the liability for them in dealing with pirated material that showed up in their search engine on sites like YouTube. And in the final weeks before the Senate was going to vote on this, these companies actually did take over their broadcasting networks to raise public awareness about this issue. So the homepage of Google was taken over, sites like Wikipedia telling people to contact their senators, and the Senate was bombarded with thousands and thousands of phone calls that effectively killed the bill. It was a huge wake-up call, not just for Silicon Valley about their power, but also the rest of Washington, you know, that you now have this new media channel that has this much power at basically no cost.
And now these tech companies are trying to get a legislator elected. Tell me about Ro Khanna and whether he's a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, Ro Khanna is a very talented candidate in a district that covers a good part of Silicon Valley proper. He's running against a politician named Mike Honda, who's been an elected representative of the same region, progressive Democrat in good standing for decades. And Ro Khanna has a very good shot right now of taking him out. Khanna has essentially a 4-to-1 spending advantage at this point. He's hired the data and grassroots people that drove President Obama's 2012 campaign. And if you talk to Ro, or if you talk to some of the supporters around him, they will say, we need a new voice directly of Silicon Valley in Congress, and Mike Honda just can't be. He can take votes that Silicon Valley is happy with, but he is not in himself an evangelist for the Valley.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Scherer is the White House correspondent for Time magazine.
Tonight, Bringing Up Baby, Royal Edition. It was the baby bump seen round the world. Now the bump is about to be born to William and Kate.
It's going to be massive. It's going to be the biggest media event, possibly of the decade.
Here now, Barbara Walters in London.
The UK media event of the decade over a royal fetus? For those of us in the finding fault with others industry, ABC's predictions about an over-the-top British media circus constituted an irresistible premise. So, like the Dennis Farina character in that Guy Ritchie movie Snatch, of course I jumped into action.
I'm coming to London!
And headed straight for the headquarters of the most uncircus-like Guardian newspaper, where my feature writing fellow traveler Hadley Freeman had already begun sneering at the royal baby hype. Sporting a motor scooter helmet, traces of her childhood American accent, and an alarming vision of neonatal nuttiness, Freeman was just what the OBGYN ordered.
This coverage is going to be so over the top and so disgustingly intrusive. Obviously, royal babies have been born before, but never before in a time when we've had such blanket media everywhere. Certainly, the British tabloids have been obsessing over her to a degree that is, frankly, kind of mentally ill.
Are secret cameras being installed? Are bribes being paid to hospital staff? What's going on at the tabloids to get the angle on this story that nobody else has?
I'm personally amazed that The Sun hasn't installed a camera up inside Kate Middleton's womb.
We were unable to gain access to the camera placements of the tabloids, but the conservative broadsheet The Daily Telegraph did give us access to its royal watcher, Gordon Rayner. He was exulting in his exclusive on the Of Cambridge family's new digs.
So, you know, royal scoops are not as easy to come by as perhaps in other areas because it's a very tightly controlled environment. We have to work pretty hard to get them.
Phone hacking?
We don't do phone hacking.
Rayner rejects the notion that the attention paid the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge is either excessive or unusual. He sees it as natural and ongoing and is already looking forward to his or her Eminence's first royal junket.
Now, interestingly, when Prince Charles and Diana had Prince William, their next royal tour was to Australia and New Zealand, and indeed they did take Prince William. So it'll be fascinating to see if history repeats itself.
I noticed you said interestingly. Is that one of those words that has a different meaning on opposite sides of the ocean?
I don't think so. I think we're all interested in the royal family.
All?
A bold statement. So I took the question to a number of British subjects, inquiring about their furiously gestating heir to the throne. The venue was Paddington, just around the bend from St. Mary's Hospital, not only where I was once personally dispatched with a tongue injury following a tragic prawn incident, but where Kate will eventually bear the future defender of the faith, commander of the Army and Navy, and nappy soiler.
And you're from?
Melbourne, Australia.
A part of the British Commonwealth. Queen Elizabeth is your queen.
She's our gal.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you about the royal heir to the throne?
Zero.
Is it Bonnie yet? Not sure.
You haven't been following every detail?
No, sorry.
Why not?
Got other things to do.
I just heard that they're going to have a baby. There's going to be a baby in the royal family.
Wait. You just heard?
Just heard. You just told me this.
Oh, yeah. It's just madness over here. But then, in a local pub, an offhand remark changed the trajectory of my entire heroic journalistic odyssey.
There's been a lot of media coverage, I gather.
Yes, there has. A lot of speculation as to whether it's going to be a boy or a girl, but nobody's really put money on one way or the other, I don't think.
Well, not true, actually.
Blue 3 has come through to take it up now. Marcus Beattie out in front.
This is the William Hill Betting Parlor in Park Lane, where the British public can bet on almost anything, including whether Kate will deliver a boy or a girl. There's also a brisk market on the baby's name. Alexandra is the prohibitive favorite at 7-4. Andrew is 40-1. Bringing up the rear at 500-1, Waynetta. But never mind that. Bookie spokesman Rupert Adams says there is definitely media madness going on. But here's where my story takes a U-turn. Rupert has done between 100 and 200 media interviews, the vast majority not by local reporters, but media outlets back in the USA. And as for the British catching up, don't bet on it.
It's 100-1. There is no hope that any country will be inquiring about the royal baby more than the US of A.
Whoa! So,
from a minicab in West London, now I'm headed for Heathrow. Ejaz the M4, please. And back at 35,000 feet, heading for where the story is.
In Royals Media Circus, USA.
Baby, oh royal baby. Here we go.
It's the royal baby countdown. Prince William and Kate in the final nesting phase.
With each passing day, that bump has been growing, and so has the tension. Is it a boy or a girl?
Kate's reportedly purchased this bugaboo chameleon stroller in a jewel blue with stylish stripes. It's considered a unisex design.
Royal sources revealed the Duchess of Cambridge will give birth at St. Mary's Hospital in London.
And now gossip abounds about how she might choose to give birth.
All the money has been for a cesarean section. People really believe she's too posh to push.
Hey, it's my man, Rupert. But lest you think I rely on bookies for my cultural analysis, know that there are posher sorts who see Americans and not Her Majesty's subjects as the real royal baby bumpkins.
I just looked and saw that some of People magazine's top grossing issues ever have related to coverage of the British royal family. And I think that the baby will bring similar kinds of levels of excitement and frenzy. We're already seeing it here.
That's Boston University history professor Ariane Chernock, who says monarchy fixation long predated Kate or Princess Diana or even the love-struck abdicator Edward VIII.
Right after the American Revolution, we see a fascination with Britain, fascination with British theater, British products, British literature. When Queen Victoria had her coronation in 1838, there was one editor for the New York Mirror who was basically driven into an apoplectic fit because he didn't know exactly what kind of slippers Victoria had worn to her coronation. This was driving him crazy.
Huh. Kind of makes you wonder how crazed, say, Barbara Walters was at the prospect of interviewing the Duchess of Cambridge herself. Talk about your royal scoops. Which brings us back to where we started this journey, ABC's hour-long examination of the royal bump. Sure enough, there was Walters in London with a very familiar face.
It's not every day you get to take a casual stroll through the streets of London with the future Queen of England.
Yeah. How are you feeling, Kate?
Very good.
The baby kicking yes. yet?
The baby's doing well.
An exclusive interview with Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge? No, not quite. It was a non-exclusive interview with Heidi Agin, waitress turned Kate Middleton look-alike, answering questions on a network news program about a baby she is not pregnant with. While I was still in London, I caught up with her waitressship.
Okay, what's the weirdest thing that ever happened to you in this gig?
There is people that do ask if they can hire me to rub my feet because it is their ultimate dream to rub Kate Middleton's feet. No lie.
Ew.
I know. So I politely decline them.
Now, I humbly submit that is not the weirdest thing because I have seen you on an ABC News magazine talking to Barbara Walters being interviewed as if you were Kate Middleton.
It was an amazing day. It's one of those things where you have to pinch yourself and just go, oh my goodness, I'm sitting next to Barbara Walters.
I know, right? Heidi? I couldn't believe it either. To dig deeper into the Kate Middleton impersonator interview, we called ABC News to speak with Barbara Walters. Hi, welcome to On the Media.
Very, very happy to be here.
Interviewing an impersonator instead of the actual personage strikes me as a bit odd journalistically.
Oh, but that's very judgmental. People make news, and people who look like people who make news make what looks like news. This sort of thing goes on all the time.
Not on this network.
Well, perhaps. But let me ask, is that corduroy you're wearing? You don't wear Yves Saint Laurent and earn $13 million a year interviewing professors about Egypt.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
ABC declined to make the real Barbara Walters available. Performer Ed Kelly is a voice actor, impressionist.
I can do an alternate as Tom Brokaw from NBC Nightly News, if you like.
You can check out his website at edkelly.tv. That's it for this week's show. Hey, Ed, help.
On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and their boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. This is not Tom Brokaw.
This is Bob Garfield.
And this is Brooke Gladstone. Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.